Bakers, florists, county clerks, proselytizing military officers, Bible-thumping coaches, and public school teachers. If you listen to the religious right, those and many others are the victims of the most egregious assault on religious liberty in history. Of course, if you scratch the surface of virtually all of these stories, you'll find instead blatant violations of constitutional principles and one-sided demands for the right to discriminate. But all too often, the surface doesn't get scratched. And even if it does, there's not much hope that these divisive strategies are going away anytime soon. Offering some hopeful strategies to move beyond this stalemate, which benefits the few but ultimately harms all of us by polarizing Americans in a way that is patently un-American, is a new report from the Center for American Progress, titled Restoring the Balance, A Progressive Vision of Religious Liberty Preserves the Rights and Freedoms of All Americans. And joining me right now is one of the report's authors, Sally Steenland, director of CAP's Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative. Sally, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's so good to be talking with you again.
The report is titled Restoring the Balance. When do you think we lost the balance on this issue, or did we ever have it?
Well, I think at one point there probably was a good balance, and you can probably answer that question better than me. If we go back to 1993, when the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed, which is being wildly misused these days, both federally and by the courts and in states. But back then, it was an attempt to be sensitive to people's religious expression, to following your beliefs and practicing your beliefs in your everyday life, while also being very careful that those beliefs do not impinge on the rights of others, do not cause discrimination, or don't force others to believe things that go contrary to their conscience. So it's been a very delicate balance. It's not like one size fits all or here's a simple answer. These are complicated matters. But we've been doing it. And what we've been seeing in states, and most recently a year ago, last June, in the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision, is, in our view, a wild misreading of what RFRA ever intended, so that balance is now tipped and we're not in a good place.
Yeah. So when you look at the religious liberty rhetoric as it's been used recently in this country, do you see certain patterns that emerge?
A pattern we see emerging is what culminated in Hobby Lobby, and what we saw really start to pick up speed and traction was when the Affordable Care Act passed, and it included a contraceptive mandate as part of preventive health care for women. So what that means is, if you're an employer and you offer a whole range of health care to your employees, one of those is preventive care for women, and that includes, you know, wellness training and diabetes screening, mammogram checkups, pap smears, things like that. But it also includes contraceptive coverage because we know how important that is to women's health and how cost-effective that is. And we also know that 99% of women have used contraception at some point in their life, and most people see it as a great public health victory and something that people just really need to make their families work and to make their families strong and healthy. So when the Catholic bishops and some other conservatives oppose that, they really couldn't say, we're against contraception, because that wouldn't get any traction. So that's where we started to see the religious liberty rhetoric, to give you high moral ground to say, it's not about contraception, it's about our conscience. And whenever you hear that, in somebody's denial of doing something, that's your ears should always perk up and say, what is this really about? And then try to translate and decipher and figure out what really might be at stake, because very often someone's rights are being infringed upon, and rather than arguing on that ground, religious liberty becomes the go-to answer.
When this religious liberty rhetoric is used, and it's really not even close to what the Constitution means when it uses the religious liberty language, who came up with their definitions? I mean, they surely know that's not what the Constitution says. It's not about religious liberty for one group of people. It's about religious liberty for all people. How do they get away with changing the definition that grows out of the Constitution?
I think they kept stretching and stretching and stretching it till it became kind of ludicrous and absurd. So, for instance, I think most of us would, or should, I would hope, agree that this country should be reasonably flexible in accommodating people's religious beliefs if they don't impose a really substantial burden on the public. So, for instance, if you are Jewish and you need to leave your workplace before sundown on Friday, many workplaces accommodate that. That's simply a policy. If you are Muslim and you pray five times a day, many workplaces, including ours at the Center for American Progress, we have a prayer room where Muslim employees can go and pray. That's an accommodation that feels very fair and that allows one to practice and exercise one's belief. Now, what a lot of conservatives and right-wing groups have done, they have really sort of twisted and distorted that to mean something quite different. Mm-hmm. So rather than exercising their religion, here's what they're asking for now. What they're saying is, it would be me saying to you, Welton, you're doing something that I don't like. And if you do what I don't like, that offends my religious liberty. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's not anything I'm doing. I'm trying to stop you from exercising your conscience and your First Amendment rights. Right. Because if you do what I say, that's an offense to me. And that's the contraceptive use, that's around marriage equality, that's all those things. So if you see how coercive that is and how that has completely flipped over from me practicing my faith to stopping you from practicing yours.
Hmm. Is there a sample case that you could highlight that really clarifies what we're talking about in terms of religious liberty arguments?
Well, there are two incidents that I can think of that have happened in this past year in a post-Hobby Lobby world where people have refused to do things that they should be doing and claiming religious freedom or religious liberty grounds. And I just want to say also, what we should stay alert to in 2016 is any state activity where someone is claiming a religious refusal, a religious exemption. I don't want to do this because of my faith. And the effect of that would be discrimination or harming somebody else. I think we're unfortunately going to see a number of those. But the two cases that I would mention, one was out in Utah, which was a fundamentalist sect of the Mormon Church, which had walnut farms, and they were using child laborers to harvest the walnuts, and it was violating state child labor laws. So there was an investigation by the state agency requiring the head of this sect to testify in court to see if, in fact, they had violated child labor laws, and he refused to testify. Because he said that one of the tenets of his religion was secrecy and not discussing the church's beliefs in public, in a courtroom setting, was in public, and it went against his violation to even testify, and he refused to do it, and he cited RFRA in the post-Hobby Lobby world. So that's pretty egregious. And then the second one, also very troubling, happened this summer in Michigan, where two women had a child, and they had picked their pediatrician before the baby was born, a pediatrician they wanted. And when the baby was, I believe, 7 days old, they took her to the pediatrician for her first appointment. And when the pediatrician saw that this infant, who she was, you know, licensed in the Hippocratic Oath to care for, saw that she had two mothers, she refused to care for her, saying that it violated her religious beliefs. So again, you see a doctor refusing to care for an infant because she objects to the configuration of that baby's family.
Goodness gracious. I think this report is so good for one reason, because it's not just descriptive, it's also prescriptive. And I'd like for you to talk about the ways you see us being able to move beyond the current stalemate.
Sure. So there are at least three things we can do, and we're working on all of them. I mean, one of them is to fix the federal RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It would just be an amendment. We're calling it the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to restore RFRA to its original intent, to amend RFRA so that it is a robust expression of free exercise of religion, but not when it causes material third-party harm to other people. And that's just another way of talking about the Establishment Clause, actually, just saying that there have always been limits to religious freedom. So that would be one, to amend the federal RFRA. And then the other is, as you know, LGBT Americans have celebrated some wonderful victories, including the Supreme Court marriage equality decision this past June. But the battle is far from over. And what we say is you can get married on Sunday and fired on Monday. And so what does not exist in this country are federal non-discrimination laws in housing and public accommodations to protect LGBT Americans against discrimination at the local, the state, and the federal law. And there's a law that's been introduced called the Equality Act. And so this law needs to become law. The good news is that most Americans think we already have a law. It's kind of shocking to people that we don't have one. And so we just need to make that thought a reality. And then we also need to pass state laws to increase access to preventive health care services for women, because whether it's a contraceptive mandate or whatever it might be, people are using religious refusals. Pharmacists refusing to provide contraceptive services to women because it goes against their beliefs, and just basic health care being in jeopardy. And so women just need, again, access to that basic health care. It's really important for progressives, for progressive people of faith, especially to call their congresspeople, to call their local representatives, and to say, this is bad legislation. I'm a Presbyterian, I'm a Methodist, I'm a Baptist. We believe in religious liberty for everybody. So it's important to get the voices heard, and whether you're at your book group, at your workplace, in your neighborhood, at your church, whatever it might be, to actually talk about this issue so that people have a sense of one can be for religious liberty, be a strong proponent of religious liberty, but not before these discriminatory measures.
Sally, how can our listeners get their hands on this Center for American Progress project?
AmericanProgress.org, and the report itself is called Restoring the Balance. Just go on our website and you can download it from there. And it's the whole report as well as an executive summary with the recommendations and everything.
Sally Steenland is the director of the Center for American Progress, Faith, and Progressive Policy Initiative. Sally, thank you for making time to be with us on State of Belief.
Well, thank you so much for letting us, you know, share this with your listeners, because we do this work inside our offices and it's really important to have your megaphone. So I thank you for that.